Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Founded in 1973 by Paul Carroll and a team of Chicago poets, the Poetry Center has presented through its annual reading series hundreds of the world's poets to the people of Chicago. This is our 29th year. 29 years is a long time to be doing this, and I think we can be proud of it, and we certainly do have fun doing it, so thanks for being here. Inside the brochure that I hope you got, you will find information about the other part of the Poetry Center, and it's called Hands on Stanzas. It's in its sixth year. It's a poetry program that places Chicago poets in Chicago public schools for year-long residencies. It's reaching 2,000 students this year, and these students are instructed how to read and write poetry, and on the side, they learn how to read better, but they don't know it, so I kind of call it rogue literacy. None of this is easy to accomplish, and we couldn't do it without the many friends that we have. I want to especially thank our volunteers. We have many new ones tonight, so thank you to all of you who are volunteers. Also, our longtime members and our new members. And if you're not a member, please join, because we need your help. I also want to thank, along with the volunteers, the Poetry Center's programs coordinator, the other staff person at the Poetry Center, Karen Ford Monza. So for the volunteers, thanks for everybody. Thank you very much. The Poetry Center is proud to be in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which is celebrating something like 131 years of living art in Chicago. So we have a little while to catch up. But I also want to thank our new radio sponsor, WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio. Support also comes from Poetry Center members, the Lannan Foundation, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council Estate Agency, the Polk Brothers Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, the Chicago Community Trust Young Leaders Fund, the Northern Trust Foundation, and the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. Tonight's event will consist of live poetry, followed by a discussion between Jory Graham and Jody Becker, and a book signing. Jody Becker is a reporter at Chicago Public Radio, specializing in education and urban affairs, but she covers just about anything Chicago. In 2000, Jody spent a year as a journalism fellow at Yale Law School with the intention of becoming better equipped to ask questions about every aspect of public life. Right now, she is happily at work on a series of stories about undiscovered, hard-at-work Chicago poets and writers. A closet poet herself, Jody, is delighted to introduce tonight's artist. Jody?
Thank you, Ken. Good evening. Tonight, we will take a tour, or several tours. Jory Graham's poems do not offer snapshots or frozen moments. Rather, to read a poem by Jory Graham is to be challenged to survey the landscape, linger among the ancients, look backward and forward and inward. What did they mean? What does this mean? What do I mean? She is not a poet who provides answers, but a skilled Sherpa among the ideas we too often live with without thoroughly examining. The critic Helen Vendler has said that Graham's departure from the confessional autobiographical narrative of the 1950s and 60s signaled the arrival of a bold and original mind, like hearing a new sound, like hearing Shostakovich after Tchaikovsky. Graham is the author of 9 collections of poetry, including the forthcoming Never. Her most recent works include Swarm, The Errancy, and The Dream of the Unified Field Selected Poems, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1996. Her many awards include a John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Fellowship, and in 1997, she was elected Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. Graham is currently the Boylston Professor of Rhetoric and Oratory at Harvard University. She's with us tonight for a much-anticipated reading, and I am pleased to warmly welcome to Chicago Jory Graham.
It's like being shot in the eye. Thank you for coming. This is a very grand place to be reading poems. I spent a little time last night in a class talking about the ways in which poetry seems like a peculiarly well-suited medium for the crises that we find ourselves in present, because of its capacity for holding paradox and multiple paradoxes of a certain kind in its body. At the most basic level, the relationship between what we call, in a very simple way, form, and what we call content, or the occasion of the poem. In fact, it's very hard to be reading poems nowadays as if one weren't in the particular historical period one is in, for many reasons, personal, reasons that involve the inevitable presence of an either inflated or real crisis that we're living through, but also because poetry is being called on as a kind of emergency room by the whole nation, so that many of us have been really running around the country from one reading to another, reading poems written over the last 1,000 years, as if for some, to me, not very mysterious reason, we had something even better than Cipro to offer. And as a result, I thought I'd read 5 poems this evening that address one of the things that concerns me the most at present in our cultural drama, and that is the capacity to not ask, the refusal to ask any soul to hold a unilateralist position in relation to anything outside of itself, but more importantly, within itself. One of the most moving things about writing poems, and certainly about poems themselves, is that they make things more complicated. They don't make them overly simple. And one of the scariest things that's perhaps happening in our culture at present is an intentional oversimplification, so that we are not permitted to feel the conflicting emotions that all of us truly feel under such circumstances. They're not the same for probably any of us, but it is possible to feel compassion and rage. It is possible to feel vengeance and forgiveness. It is possible to feel many different emotions at once, and it's the signal activity of poets and poetry to attempt to allow that activity to take place within the human soul. So I'm going to read. Thank you. I'm going to read poems, 5 poems that involve my relationship with history, and in this case, they're going to be poems that take place among facts, i.e. times in my life in which perhaps my life in its everyday occasions coincided with what felt like my life as a citizen, or my life as a member of that current that we call history at any given moment, but held simultaneously in play with myself as a very single and powerless spirit. Myself as an American, myself as a neighbor, myself as a stranger in a city. The first poem is from my very first book. I was a wee thing when I wrote it, and it has a kind of quiet nostalgia for what Carlos Drummond de Andrade called the ancient world, in a wonderful poem called Souvenir of the Ancient World, translated beautifully by Mark Strand, who is with us tonight. As I read it, it's hard to remember that this could have been the occasion for a poem, but it's a poem that takes place in a backyard in a house in Kentucky when I have done the laundry and I'm hanging it out to dry. And I place this poem first on the table tonight as a tonal marker for what the normal once felt like from the perspective of a CNN-inflated American. the geese. Today, as I hang out the wash, I see them again, a code as urgent as elegant, tapering with goals. For days they have been crossing. We live beneath these geese, as if beneath the passage of time, or a most perfect heading. Sometimes I fear their relevance. Closest at hand, between the lines, the spiders imitate the paths the geese won't stray from, imitate them endlessly to no avail. Things will not remain connected, will not heal, and the world thickens with texture instead of history, texture instead of place. Yet the small fear of the spiders binds and binds, the pins to the lines to the eaves, to the pincushion bush, as if at any time things could fall further apart and nothing could help them recover their meaning. And if these spiders had their way, chain link over the visible world, would we be in or out? I turn to go back in. There is a feeling the body gives the mind of having missed something. A bedrock poverty, like falling without the sense that you are passing through one world, that you could reach another anytime. Instead, the real is crossing you, your body, an arrival you know is false but can't outrun. And somewhere in between these geese forever entering and these spiders turning back, this astonishing delay, the everyday, takes place. This next poem takes place again in a place which would make news. In this case, it takes place in Paris in 1968, and tells about my participation in what were the student uprisings of 1968. I don't think I need to tell you very much. I think it's all strangely self-evident. I think of Pound telling us that poetry brings the news. Sometimes the news brings poetry. The hiding place. The last time I saw it was 1968. Paris, France, the time of the disturbances. We had claims, schools shut down, 1 million workers and students on strike, marches, sit-ins, helicopters, gas. They stopped you at gunpoint asking for papers. I spent 11 nights sleeping in the halls. Arguments, negotiations. Hurrying in the dawn looking for a certain leader, I found his face above an open street fire. "No," he said, "tell them no concessions." His voice above the fire as if there were no fire. Language floating everywhere above the sleeping bodies, and crates of fruit donated in secret, and torn sheets for tear gas tossed down from shuttered windows, and bread and blankets stolen from the firehouse. The CRS, the government police, would swarm in around dawn in small blue vans and round us up. Once I watched the search beams play on some flames, the flames push up into the corridor of light. In the cell, we were so crowded no one could sit or lean. People peed on each other. I felt a girl vomiting gently onto my back. I found two Americans rounded up by chance. Their charter left that morning, they screamed. What were they going to do? Later, a man in a uniform came in with a stick, started beating here and there, found the girl in her eighth month. He beat her frantically over and over. He pummeled her belly, screaming, "Aren't you ashamed?" I remember the cell vividly, but is it from a photograph? I think the shadows as I see them still, the slatted brilliant bits against the wall, I think they're true, but are they from a photograph? Do I see it from inside now, his hands, her face, or is it from the news account? The strangest part of getting out again was streets, the light running down them, everything spilling whenever the wall breaks, and the air thick with dwellings, the air filled, doubled, as if the open had been made to render. The open squeezed for space until the hollows spill out, story upon story of them, starting to light up as I walked out. How thick was the empty meant to be? What were we finding in the air? What were we meant to find? I went home slowly, sat in my rented room. Sat for a long time, the window open. Watched the white gauze curtain slough this way, then that a bit. Watched the air suck it out, push it back in. Lung of the room with street cries in it. Watched until the lights outside made it gold, pumping gently. Was I meant to get up again? I was inside. The sentry clicked by. The woman below called down not to forget the loaf. Crackle of helicopters. Voice on a loudspeaker issuing warnings. They made agreements. We all returned to work. The government fell, but then it was all right again. The man above the fire, listening to my question, the red wool shirt he wore, where is it? Who has it? He looked straight back into the sentry. No concessions. I took the message back. The look in his eyes, shoving out, into the open, expressionless with thought. No. Tell them no. I'm going to read three more poems, just so you don't panic, because this one's long and then the other two aren't. This one's in four sections, so it's called a quartet. It takes place on a number of different trains, so it's called Relativity, a quartet. You might remember the relationship between Einstein and trains. If you were to take a train along the Northeast Corridor, say between New York and Boston, and the train were to stop, as they often do when they are in a slowdown or they break down for some reason, they usually are in the middle of a very narrow track, and on one side there is water, and on the other side there are trees. And very often they don't trim the tracks very well, and there are leaves that press against the window frame and against the glass. It's actually quite terrifying, because one imagines that one would notice that if one was going by it at speed. Everything in here actually happened, and I don't think I should say much else about it. The fourth section takes place in a train that I refer to as the Express from a certain stop in New York City. It's an express train that goes faster than a local train in Manhattan. And just be patient. It's to be over before you know it. And each section will be different, so if you're just going crazy, just wait for the next one. I unfortunately have to go through all of it. Okay. It seems, again, appallingly relevant. And I wrote, this is about four books back, or it seems like a long time ago. Maybe five books back. Relativity, a quartet. One. During the slowdown, we lost power along the northeast corridor. It taking a moment before I realized we were at a crawl, then the slow catch, and we were still. I heard the cars behind me each receive the jolt of stillness, felt the transfer of inertia slither through, creaking, then an aftershock along the backbone. Nothing shrill. A hiss clenched it. Across the aisle, a girl and her father woke, looked out. Monologue of going and going interrupted. The land looked truant, incomplete. On their side, through trees, the ocean looked too pressed with definition, incomparability. What is it that leaks out of it, seen, once it's the untheoretical here? Sylvan, yes, but almost dishonored by mere still being. On my side, leaves against the glass, and then left frame on the rooftop of some walled industrial facility, a mounted scanning video cam. Searching for what? Inside the walls, then out. No windows there, below a parking lot. Lens all one way, then back the other way. Where is, I think, watching again, the blind spot in its turn? Across the aisle, now lights are out, the sea's skin gleams. Two clouds, two evergreens. My neighbors have gone back to sleep. When does it change, the frame around her scene, the frame around my scene? After a while, I see he's not her dad. Then that they're stoned and cannot help the sleep. The sea that holds them in its frame, stuck there, itself is stuck, slick, gaping eyelessness. Where is the news account? Where is the varnished sea? Where the ventriloquial sea, the fast train panning glints, scribble of shifting points of view, wave tips frothing as the eye blinks and the venue slips to the new sea of faces, say, of houses, and then some even newer sea hiding its monster, wide-eyed. I want it to be again what it was, to go by and go by. As if matter itself were going on and on to its own destination, bouquet of instances collecting all the swift and cunning and mercenary appearances, swish, so that it's there, there, and we can, swaying slightly, eyes still, eyes absolutely open, receptive and still, let it lay itself down frame by frame onto the wide, resistanceless opening of our wet retina, more and more, all the debris, all the astonishments, quicker than single file, smearing onto us, undestined, undestinied. But it is still. It does not move. Two. Against my pain, flat leaves that would bury themselves into the molecules of glass, pressed right up to my eye, so close they blur, the flat cold lingering against my skin as I pull back. A scribble of only, lowly, green ribbon, they twitch, no wind. they peck a bit, now wind. A stratagem for genuine utterance. Cunning, teasing the invisible, tender-minded spectrum of. The cam keeps saying something about sight, about the guaranteed freshness of the world repeating itself without meaning. Leaf, leaf. Shanavasa asked Ananda, what is the fundamental uncreated essence of all things? Come back with empty hands, he said, and where can dust collect? Time and again, wipe it diligently. And there has never been anything given to another. There has never been anything received from another. Look close, I think. Stem, node, bract, pedicel. I count the greens. I slow along the veins. And shadow, how it slithers along the rib, how it is seized, fretted, shouldered here and slipped off there, so that no two faces match, each branch a sea of individual tremblings. I want to see through. My window does not open, or I'd take a leaf. From here, against the light, the chlorophyll exists inside the plasts, and where sun is strongest, light thickens, drawing the carbon in. Oxygen steams off. Sun picks up mist. Under the face of it, I see the pores between the veins, where the carbon molecule must pass, where the hydrogen molecule must pass. Inside, inside. Envelope, rib, protein, thylakoid, starch grain, acid strand, and the cuticle of the leaf brim, and the loosely packed layer of photosynthetic tissue, guard cells, substomatal chambers. I blink. I don't see anything. Lord, I want to see this leaf. I'd shut my hand all round it. I'd press it tight. 3. What does she have, my twin, the sleeper, there, unseized in her window sea? God's adversary, the waters, unfanged, unhanded, unlimbed, unheaded, hooves and hooves and hooves and hooves. The protozoa bloom all over its back. It hunches and slacks, amasses and slacks. All its passageways gleam. They breathe, the two of them. They have a shopping bag on the floor between them, a large toy train in glistening packaging, red, white, and blue, and green, and chrome. Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Thou driest up the mighty river. The day is thine. Thou hast prepared the light. Thou hast set all the borders of. When the waves of the sea arise, thou stillest them with thy strong arm. Awake, awake. Thou hast made over the deep of the sea a way for the ransomed to pass over. Green leaves, cloth to shroud the deep, ride above the deep, ride in your chariot of shapeliness. Clean, shut, not this and not this. Destroy with one seed the monster's skull. Thrust with one stem a sword into its heart. And the waters fled backwards, and the endlessness fearfully surrendered. And the branching dried up the floods, dividing, dividing. And the minutes sang each to each. And the minutes the sons of God shouted for joy, tick-tock. Thus the work of creation was completed. And I see on her arms the needle tracks. His neck, long where it's tossed in sleep, has tracks. And the tops of her hands folded, tracked. She's wearing running shoes. She's shivering, asleep and shivering. Wouldn't you cover her with the man-sized coat bunched up beside her? Just take it gently like this, holding my breath, and pull it over her like this, as if to hide her. But she will waken suddenly and think I'm stealing it and scream and will not listen where I'm trying to explain. She hits my face, making my right eye smart. It's like a dream, but it is not a dream. 4. What would you cover up? What recover from his sight? What restore to the deep sleep? And why? Her. We have been monitoring developments. The first shells fell just 100 yards from. Others were killed on the way, too. As the search for food becomes more difficult, lost his legs on the way, too. Earlier, the representative said, the People's Congress said, the Prime Minister said, lost his legs in the attack up the front steps. Others were killed on the way, too. Others were killed on the way, too. And in a border skirmish at dawn, the parties involved pledged, what is the fundamental uncreated essence of all things, the representative asked. Come back with empty hands, the minister pledged. In 1982, on the downtown express just out of 72nd Street, having found a seat in what is like a dream, the sideways rocking mixed in with the forward lunge making me slightly sleepy, watching the string of faces lined up across from me, the interlocking vertebrae of the endless twisting creature's spine, watching it lob to absorb the shocks, watching it twist all one way to wreathe the rudderless turns, watching the eyes in it narrow, widen as the tunneling forwardness cleaved to its waiting like flesh, widen and narrow, blinking the whole length of the train, I thought, this dynamism of complex acceptance, sleepy, staring out, blinking, some equation getting counted out, change by change, sometimes the elbows touching, sometimes the seam at the thigh, plus or minus, some long bit of thought, what needs to be undergone that the solution be found, sleepy, then an utterly single sound, saw-toothed, a fragment of some vacuum flew into the car, and the woman beside me doubled over, and faster the figures in the long equation began to bend and twist and stand, a long distorted sound, then a snapping into the present tense like surfacing, and M grabbed me and pushed me down, down, he shrieked, and shoved me behind the last row of seats, and the boy, waving the gun, made a shape in the air above his head like a wave breaking upon a rock. Or was he giving up? A shape in the invisible which expresses hope. Then down came the arm again, and more shots and screams, the boy bending forward with his long extended arm as if trying to include something in himself, as if trying to sharpen himself for entry. The room, a brightly lit hole hurtling through space at 90 miles per hour, a hole with screams and lights and bullets traveling round, holding the emptiness together so that it matters, light and blood swirling, us down here on our knees in secret, living my portion of time, my portion, full. Can you stand it? Get down and hide. Live fast, cloth over a sea. Breathe. And at the heart of the living whole, the boy, acid, rare, in support of progress, looking for what he's missed, laughing, gun at the end of his arm, over his head, swinging back, tentacular, spitting seed, him the stalk of the day, scattering seed, planting it deep, here and here, into everything he reaches. All things can happen, wave after wave, seek and thou shalt find, and yet so unlikely, so that one is not sure of having seen. Wet branches? What was I wearing? And then, much later, like a dream, desolate, things being talked about. Because it's been missing, this poem has, but you have to be paying attention because it goes by fast, some sex in it. I think it's, again, an attempt to try to figure out what an other is to a one. Titled Underneath 13. And sex doesn't come right away, but then sex never does. So you have to go through the theoretical part first. We call it foreplay, thinking. Underneath 13, needed explanation. Because of the mystic nature of the theory and our reliance on collective belief, I could not visualize the end. The tools that paved the way broke. The body, the foundation, the exact copy of the real. Our surfaces were covered. Our surfaces are all covered. Actual hands appear, but then there is writing. In the cave, we were deeply impressed, as in addicted to results. Oh, and dedication, training, the idea of loss of life. In our work, we call this emotion, how a poem enters into the world. There is nothing wrong with the instrument. As here, I would raise my voice, but the human being and the world cannot be equated. Aside from the question of whether or not we are alone and other approaches to nothingness, the term subject, the term only, also opinion and annihilation, the body's minutest sensation of time. The world, it is true, has not yet been destroyed. Intensification. Void. We are amazed. Uselessness is the last form love takes. So liquid till the foregone conclusion. Here we are, the foregone conclusion. So many messages transmitted, they will never acquire meaning. Do you remember? My love, my archive. Touch me here. Give birth to a single idea, touch where it does not lead to war. Show me exact spot, climb the stairs, lie on the bed, have faith, nerves wearing only moonlight, lie down, lie still, patrol your cage, be a phenomenon. At the bottom, below the word. Intention, lick past it. Rip years. find the burning matter. Love allows it, I think. Push past freedom, smoke. Push past intelligence, smoke. Whelm, sprawl. Favorite city, God's tiny voices. Hand over mouth, let light arrive. Let the past strike us and go. Drift, undo, if it please the dawn. Lean down, say, hurt, undo. In your mouth, be pleased. Where does it say? Where does it say? This is the mother tongue. There is in my mouth a ladder. Climb down. Presence of world. Impassable gap. Pass. I am beside myself. You are inside me as history. We exist. Meet me.
Going to be a brief conversation between Jody and Jory, and then after that, a brief question answer, and I will hand you this mic to ask your questions. This is being taped by Cable Access Network Television. It will view later for their audience of about 1 million, so that's why we'll use this. So, when you guys are ready.
I have way too many questions. Questions as well, so I'll ask one or two questions and then we'll invite questions. I think because of your choice of poems tonight, talking about history to history and personal history, the nexus of the personal history and history, I'm wondering if you can talk about a little bit in this moment what kind of tension there is for a writer in the face of a historical moment. Is your job, more or less, to confront that or to provide a refuge from that?
A.
Immediately, do people, I mean, you alluded to poetry becoming the immediate emergency room of the 911 crisis. Is there an expectation that poets like clergy are on call? This is your season, and
well, no, I think that I've actually thought about it, partly because a great many foreign journalists at this point have been, I think, asking a lot of American poets why it is that this culture has turned with really an enormous, almost surprising amount of energy towards poetry under these conditions. And I think there are two answers for me, from my point of view. One is in the nature of poetry itself, and I alluded to it at the beginning of the talk. Poetry, by definition, if you talked about this a little bit in the class last night, but if you just imagine something like a sonnet, because it's a good example and most people know what one is, a sonnet is an intersection of an iambic rhythm in pentameter lines that begins long before the poem is ever uttered and continues long after the poem is concluded. And that rhythm, that tick-tock, 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 if you will, is an absolute mass. It's indifferent to human life on some visceral level. It represents something that we would think of as immortal or absolute or in any way cold. Not laced with human desire, and rather wonderfully different and indifferent to it, and also a power that one wishes one could engage in a conversation with, harness, take some of the power of its larger-than-human viscera, really, into the human soul. At the same time, when a poet like Wyatt or Donne or Shakespeare or Cummings or whoever enters into a sonnet, what you have is an individual lyric sensibility, a particular soul that engages something absolute from a condition of private need and grief or joy or temptation or whatever, and bends the sonnet's absolute measure to his or her inflections, his or her voice or needs, turns it where his or her crisis occurs, restores balance where his or her balance is restored. We call those engagements with the absolute form substitutions. And from a prosodical point of view, you know, you put in an extra, you reverse a foot, you make an anapest, or you put in a, you change the meter slightly. And that's a place where the heat of the individual lyric need engages the absolute force. But at the same time, the absolute force presses back and compels the poet to take in some of the knowledge and wisdom of something that absolute and that indifferent and that mathematically pure, crystalline, really, and something that began in the silence and will continue into the silence. So it's something that partakes of silence, and it has silence in its marrow, that this poet, in his or her crisis or engagement or need or conversation, needs to be affected by and is stained by. Now, that transaction will inevitably produce a poem which has in it simultaneously exclusive, maybe even contradictory truths. You know, I love it when Whitman says, "Do I contradict myself?" Very well, then I contradict myself. A poem is something which is why it's so badly taught in most schools, because teachers assume that there's a right answer to the horrible question, what did the poet mean? The poet meant X and Y. The poet meant what the form says in the poem, and then what the words as they are transformed and engage the form, say. And there's an incredibly complicated truth. And I think that kind of attraction to complex, paradoxical, and simultaneous, you know, an art, a medium that can hold so many different equally true sensations in it at once. We are fated, we are free. You know, we are in the grip of something that cares not a whit for us. We are in the grip of something that if we speak loud enough, we can change and it will listen, etc., just to give you just tiny examples, is very attractive to a people, even if they're not thinking about that, at a time when they're being compelled by a society to oversimplify everything in order to be kept really in a state of numb fear and be controllable. So I think turning to things that are difficult, things that require one to feel and think at the same time in ways that are a push-pull situation, is probably very attractive to the soul, if not to the psychology, but the psychology gets people into the auditorium. The second answer I would give to that is a different one. It has to do with having grown up in Europe. It seems to me that if you grow up, as I did, in a place where you can, you know, lose your sweater in the Roman Forum and have to go back and get it before dark so you don't get into trouble, or if you have the Pont de Nîmes down the road, or Stonehenge is, you know, in your country, or if you have an aqueduct that you have to go through to get to the parking lot, you have this unbelievable sense of, you know, 1,000 years or more, in many cases, of history that are really there for you in your everyday life. And although one might not be aware of it except under such conditions as these, the sense of a very deep past really does contextualize and frame the sensation of what your piece of time might be on that length of a piece of time that you, especially in countries unlike America, but like most of the rest of the world, where you feel the presence of prior human habitation, desires, wars, loves, architectural genius, etc., ingenuity, stretching back as far and further than you can witness. It also allows for an equivalent sort of mirroring sense of a deep future that sort of can be posited and which frames the other side of your sense of your own individual piece of duration that you call your life. Now, in the United States, we don't have that except in the realm, perhaps, of geology or at the level of nature. We manage to kill off the populations that and destroy the cultures of the populations that lived here in a way that would have given us a continuous ancestry. So as far as the United States as we know it, and as we tend to live in it culturally is concerned, we have a really slim purchase on that arc of time that we call history. In fact, it's such a slippery, slim purchase, it's just a couple of hundred years, really, that we, I think, really doubt our actual legitimate presence on the curve of history. Certainly we're just gripping, just, you know, very barely on a curve that other cultures just live and are carried on the huge cycle of. And as a result, we don't have that sense of a very deep past. We have a very inflated and terrifyingly fragile, therefore, notion of our present and what we're supposed to do with our life in our present, in our freedom, with our responsibilities, but our also, you know, the obligations of the democracy to us and ours to it, but it's enormous if we only got 300 years behind us. And our sense of the future, if you have that mirroring effect missing, is very fragile. But we have one thing that's equivalent to the Roman Forum or the Pont de Nîmes or whatever, and that's the English language. The English-American language, which, because it's so fabulously absorptive and because it crossed an ocean and because it's been writing itself in poetry for over 1,000 years, is the living constituent fabric of our purchase on history. And the oldest exemplars, really, that we have to turn to in the English language are often poems. You know, prose tends to develop, you know, alongside it, but at a later date, and texts like the Bible are something we receive in translation, so that there's a way in which some of our oldest claims to being part of the human part of history are in our poems. And I think it's an unconscious recognition. But the thing that's most thrilling to people is to hear the oldest poems that one can find to read. And it gives people a very strong sense that the current flowing through them is a legitimately long current, and that one, you know, has a place on it, that is, one's utterance has a place on this enormous scope of utterances. And what's beautiful about the American English language is, unlike, say, the French language, which tends to resist intrusions by the virus of other languages, the American English language has Dutch and Spanish and Native American words and French, and it has stolen words from any language it could possibly steal from, and it has done so because it's a mercantile language. It's a language that tried from the very beginning to sell to people, stuff to people who didn't speak the language that the sellers were speaking. So they learned the buyer's language. And, you know, you go along the eastern seaboard, they learned every darn language that anybody would pay money if they knew how to use. And they just took an incredible vocabulary into the heart of the language. What's really sad is that we probably have 10 times as many words as most languages, certainly more 10 times more than any Romance language. But we use a smaller percentage of the words in our language than anybody speaking French or German or Italian, for the most part. We have more nouns, more verbs. We have this unbelievable storehouse of vocabulary, and we have the slimmest working vocabulary of practically any people on the planet. It's a real tragedy, and it's something that I think makes us frightened. And if I could just, you know, make one plea, it's for, you know, anybody who is connected to the teaching of poetry that might be in this room, especially before the college age level. It is so incredibly useful to teach small children poems, not as texts to be imitated so that the vanity of their own self-creation is taken advantage of, but as texts to be memorized and recited, as they do in every country practically on this planet except for this one. You can go to Baghdad or Beijing or Rome or Paris or London or Tel Aviv, and people are having their children memorize and recite poems because they know that there is a huge amount of cultural store in poetry, that if you just take it in and, you know, they're used for memorization, to strengthen the muscle of memorization. They're used for developing vocabulary. They're used for elocution, they're used for spelling, they're used for whatever you want to use them for. And until the 1950s, if you look at the McGuffey readers of the last century, we used poetry in that way routinely in this country. And I think some teachers are beginning to bring it back into the curriculum. But, you know, rather than teach it as if it were something that had to be unpacked and unlocked and something that the teacher had the magic sort of key for in their pocket, so that at the end of the terrifying reading of the poem, the student has to answer that terrifying question about, you know, I couldn't answer the question, what did frost mean at the end of stopping by woods and snowy evening? I have miles to go before I sleep. What does he mean? He means he has miles to go before he sleeps. And he means it twice. And he doesn't mean it the same way the second time. And it's really interesting to say to fourth graders, what does it mean when you say something twice? Why doesn't it sound the same the second time? How does it sound different? Does it sound more tired? Does it sound less tired? I mean, just starting from that little seed of, why does he say it twice? You get to sort of this extraordinary conversation that you can have with a child that will completely unpack Robert Frost. You don't have to have the teacher telling the student this is a poem that the book says is about, you know, thinking of killing oneself, or whatever the formula that the bottom of the textbook gives the teacher as an answer. At any rate, that's one of the reasons I deeply am so committed to memorization and recitation that I add an hour to the beginning of any of my, even my graduate classes, and I have my students recite, memorize and recite poems. I have to tell the older kids that it's a good seduction tool, and that it's great in a bar at night, you know, it's really, and it does work. That's my very long answer for why I think that, you know, we turn to poetry. There are many other leaves to this particular tree.
I'll try one more. It looks like Ken is eager to let people participate. But you gave us one brand new poem tonight and one from your very first book. I'm wondering if you can talk about how your work as a poet has changed through your career, and how the work of a poet has changed through your career. So not necessarily that your life has hewed to how you see people conceptualizing the work of a poet, but perhaps answering a little bit of both of those.
I don't think I can answer that question. Quite honestly, I'm just as bereft in front of a blank piece of paper now as I was 25 years ago. And I'm just as desperately lonely, having finished a book between books, as I was, I discovered after finishing my first book. There are obviously things that I've learned, technical things, but they don't really amount to very much. I have lived a life through the writing of the poems that I couldn't have lived alongside them. When you write a poem, it's a way of having the experience that poem, say that you are on that train and that happens and you try to cover up this girl and she slaps you and you see what's going on. That's the experience. But then when you go home and you trawl back through that experience with all the technique that you have and everything that you can muster, you live that piece of life at the experiential level in a way that is completely different than the experiential level of simply being on the train. And for me, poetry involves that kind of greed that probably increases increased for me once I began to understand its nature, for a greed that really involves wanting to go have the experience rather than just feeling that I was having, on some level, the report of the experience for myself. It's not like you go home and write the poem about the experience. It's as if for a poet at a certain point you go home and you actually have the experience when you write the poem, and that a very small portion of it was graspable in the moment of the occurrence. The experience is the poem. The occurrence, if you will, is the event. And more and more, I have felt that poetry as a journey, or poetry as a practice. And it's one of many kinds of practice. There are people here in many different fields, and I think probably to become good at any field is to have the same experience, or to become devoted and to just spend a lifetime at it. I don't even think you need to be good, but it's a practice for going through much life that I think I would otherwise go around. And I spend most of my life going around experiences as they happen to me. Because I'm not, you know, we talk about being there. Well, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to be present. One of the most moving things I ever read was the work of a theologian in which he was talking about the only obligation that a human soul might have, which is different, and it's something that differentiates a human being from anything else in nature. A tree has no way of not being present to the outer limits of its being. A bird has no way of not being present. Only the human can withdraw from the limits of its being and not be fully present. Only the soul can, as if, pull back from the edges of being and be inside in a way that is not out to the outer limits of its capacities. And that obligation that this theologian was talking about, to be present as the one perhaps true obligation that we might have to in life. I mean, we obviously have many other obligations, but the one to make oneself present seemed to me very haunting and right and true, and a command that I think I have followed all my life. It's very, very hard to do, and I use poems to make myself present. Other people use other means. I remember when I read it, I was struck by a very vivid memory that I had of when I was at the Lycée as a child. If you were absent from school, they would always call your name out at the beginning, and your name would sort of resound in the air, and then someone would say, absent, meaning, you know. And I used to be horrified at the idea of being sick, because the word absent would follow my name when it was called out. I didn't want to be absent. So if anything, my understanding of how to make myself present has developed because my technique has developed. But otherwise, you know, it's the same. I was trying in that yard hanging up the laundry to do that too. Just got more busy.
Finally, I'm wondering if you could briefly comment on new voices, poets that you are reading or in contact with as a teacher and instructor, who you might want to share some of what they're working on, or some names or some poems that...
This is one of the richest secrets in America. We have a generation of poets in their 30s, which is just astonishing. I mean, I really couldn't begin to name them, because I'd forget someone and wake up in the middle of the night horrified. But poetry is extraordinarily healthy in this country, and various, and adventuresome, and courageous, and astonishingly inventive. I mean, it's one of its golden eras right now, and there are many of them in the room, and many not in the room. And I don't want to name anybody. I'll have to go to the bookstore and pull books off the shelf, and if something strikes you, buy it, and buy books of poetry. You know, I often think about this. We want small independent publishers and books of poetry published by them to stay alive. Book of poetry costs maybe $10 or $11 in paperback. Oh, we spend that on a People magazine and a Sunday Times. You know, and we don't ask of Time magazine or the Sunday Times that it be great when we pick it up. Like, I'm going to spend this $9 or $10 at the newsstand, but only if it's great. But we go into a bookstore and we think, well, I'm not going to buy this book of poetry unless it's really good. Well, why not just vote with your $11 to keep independent publishers in business. And even if you just give it out to the first person in the street that you meet, just throw it away. Give it to, you know, donate it to the first homeless person. You know, just vote with your $10 once a month and buy a book of poems. It doesn't have to be great. You just have to vote to keep it alive.